protecting Iraqi shipping in the Gulf from Iranian interdiction to ensure Iran's submission. He's talking about the first Gulf War. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, going out to you via 90.7 FM from our great big red and white transmitter on the West Hills and other frequencies in Cascadia, and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is 10 o'clock. Coming up next on the Heather McCoy Show, Heather will talk to Laura Wagner of Deadspin.com to talk about the Raiders' signing of Richie Incognito, as well as the marketing partnership between the Boston Bruins and Barstool Sports. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to Morgan Parker about her new book, Magical Negro. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Black Queer Pride Celebration on Sunday, June 2nd from noon to 4:30 p.m. at Multnomah County Central Library in Portland. The Black Queer Pride Celebration explores what it means to be Black, queer, and in Portland with a panel discussion, performances, and more to honor the resilience and uplift the voices of the most marginalized. Again, that's the Black Queer Pride Celebration on Sunday, June 2nd from noon to 4:30 p.m. at Multnomah County Central Library, 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Cool art, live music, cider, wine, and snacks. Heck yeah.
Come out to KBOO's first ever First Friday Art Walk event on June 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. The First Friday Art Walk is in Portland's vibrant East Side Arts District and is the gateway into Portland's thriving arts culture, including more than 23 independent galleries.
Start your night off at the KBOO Studios next First Friday, June 7th. KBOO is featuring the work of two brilliant artists, Justin Auld and Amy Kutab. There will be live music, snacks, wine available thanks to Hip Chicks Do Wine and Cider courtesy of Cider Riot.
You will also get a chance to tour our studios. Check out kboo.fm for more info. That's Friday, June 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Yesterday, the Oakland Raiders of the NFL signed noted racist and bully Richie Incognito to a one-year contract. In a tangentially related story, the Boston Bruins of the NHL started a marketing deal with Barstool Sports. Laura Wagner of Deadspin.com is here to discuss these developments. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on short notice. Let's start with on the rotisserie of our racism, misogyny, and homophobia with Richie Incognito. For listeners who may have forgotten, give us a rap sheet of what Richie Incognito does.
Sure. So he's probably best known, infamously, for his bullying of Jonathan Martin and also a Japanese trainer when he was with the Miami Dolphins. So he racially abused them and tortured them, and eventually it ended up blowing up his that phase of his career. So since then, he's also been busy. He picked a fight with the Vikings after they declined interest in signing him. He had a meltdown at a gym where the police had to be called and he was placed in psychiatric hold. He threatened an employee at a funeral home because he reportedly wanted to cut off his dead father's head. And he has generally seemed, you know, a little unstable. In fact, he's not even healthy enough to play football. He said before the 2018 season that his liver and kidneys were shut down and that he was, you know, for his health, he was not going to play.
But yet he signed a one-year prove-it deal with the Raiders. How much of this is the Raiders' dysfunction with Mark Davis kind of being an absent owner with a bad haircut and John Gruden's inability to really be a coach anymore?
A lot of it can probably be chalked up to dysfunction, like you mentioned. But the other thing is just expediency. I mean, this deal allows them to, if he doesn't work out, if he's not capable of contributing to the team, they can release him without a penalty. And if he does end up still being able to physically play football, even if he should not be playing for his own health, they get a player for an extremely low amount of money. So it's kind of a mixture of both, but it's also not really a surprise when you look at the other players that they've brought on. They signed Vontaze Burfict, who's also known for being, you know, a quote-unquote character. He's one of the dirtiest players in the league. And then the line coach has his own sordid history. He was accused of hitting his past female romantic partners. ESPN had a story on it in 2009. So there's a lot going on here, just beyond Richie Incognito.
And that would be Tom Cable, who used to be the head coach for the Raiders at one point, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, it's weird to have your a former head coach be back in your organization at all, let alone be an underling to somebody else. Two of the recent incidents that you mentioned for Richie Incognito really stand out to me. The first was a meltdown at the public gym, which he threatened people with, threw a weight through in the pool, all while claiming, quote, the NSA level 3 documents were running through his phone. The second is in the aftermath of his father passing, he threatened employees of a funeral home, threats including the telling the staff that he had guns in his truck, and he was quite loaded when the police got there. I think there was a Glock and a few other guns. I think the part of the story which doesn't get covered enough as far as attention goes is the fact that if he had been a person of color or not a well-off NFL player, this man would have been in jail currently and not wearing an NFL jersey. Talk about the white privilege inherent within the NFL.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, just looking at who gets these second and third chances is really telling. I mean, you make a good point that if he was black or a person of color, he definitely would not be given this leniency.
Yeah, and then like I think part of it too is like aside from the Jacksonville Jaguar owner, all of the owners are white. As we were talking about Tom Cable and his return to the Raiders is not as head coach. They just, I think part of the white privilege is the just old coaches that suck and then they get recycled. And then there's a huge percentage of players who are of color. And then they never get coaching positions at any like statistical number that means much.
Yeah, I mean, the NFL has a Rooney Rule that's supposed to address this inequality in coaches to bring more black coaches into the NFL, or, you know, just try to make it more equitable. But there's a lot of problems with that as well, and it hasn't really had the desired effect.
Yeah. This is GM Mike May Rock talking to the press. I'm going to play this clip. Let's go. And it's not basically, I'm not, for some reason my computer's not playing it, but basically he's saying that at the end of the day we can't have all Boy Scouts and we've done our homework. It really makes you wonder what constitutes, quote, their homework.
Yeah, I think as long as they feel like they can bring in someone with name recognition, then they can, you know, pass it off as something that's good for the team. And I think it's at this point it's kind of up to the media and fans especially to you know, make their feelings known about it.
And I think one of the other things is that gets lost is I was rereading all of, for show prep, I was rereading the highlights that you guys published from the independent NFL investigation of what happened between Richie Incognito and Jonathan Martin. I think a lot of people have forgotten the Miami Dolphins really created a culture in which this hazing was allowed to occur, including a kangaroo court which enforced so-called snitch rule. I think it's also worth noting that the current LA Chargers center Mike Pouncey was involved with Jonathan Martin's hazing, and he has the privilege of continuing his NFL career. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of accountability anywhere, and then it doesn't seem like fans have enough economy of scale, as it were, to hold the NFL accountable at all.
Yeah, I mean, the lack of consequences for Incognito and Pouncey, as you said, they're still getting chances to play in the NFL. I think mostly speaks to a failing of the NFL, but the NFL has proven time and time again with domestic violence and brain trauma and you know, how they respond to allegations of other crime, that they're mostly just concerned with making sure that the product on the field is going to continue to be entertaining, and everything else kind of doesn't matter as much.
I'll never forget Roger Goodell's basically saying that they want to be a leader in the domestic violence space, like it's some kind of market, niche marketing. They're just so odd. Is there anything that, any overriding narrative that you can kind of like basically tie into, see why is NFL culture so backwards?
Yeah, so part of it is the fact that the NFL is trying to implement this kind of extrajudicial system on the league. There are ways that police and judges and courts deal with domestic violence. The NFL is trying to kind of subvert all of that to handle it on their own, but they don't have the best, their interests do not align with the interest of justice. So for example, my colleague at Deadspin, Diana Moskowitz, has done a lot of good work on what the NFL should be doing to alleviate and better deal with domestic violence by the players. And a big part of it is not zero tolerance. Zero tolerance doesn't help the victims primarily. It doesn't provide ways for rehabilitation. And it also puts the NFL in a position to mete out this justice instead of turning whatever they have over to investigators or law enforcement. So the NFL is completely backward on that, but as long as they can say, oh, we care about domestic violence, then it doesn't matter if they actually do.
As you're pointing out, Diana has done a lot of really good articles on the NFL's extrajudicial justice system. It also brings up the fact that it is ownership that's doing that, and it's an ownership labor issue, which is, it should be bound by the CBA, but somehow is the kangaroo courts that the NFL have set up, is it addressed in the labor agreement with the NFLPA?
I think there is language in the CBA, I think, that gives players some recourse, although I'm not sure exactly how that relates to dealing with domestic violence.
Yeah. The other thing that I was reminded of as you were talking was when Ray McDonald was arrested in his rape case, the 49ers were found out to have police, San Francisco police on the payroll to give him a heads up. So, right. Like, where, as you pointed out, there's a fallacy that came out of the Ray Rice thing where if you have zero tolerance, it gives, you know, it's going to crack down on the perpetrators, but it also gives the teams incentives to keep the criminal behavior underground. Where is a line between, like, proper, I don't know if the word punishment's the right word, but proper noting of a bad act has been committed and versus letting it just go and boys will be boys and that kind of crap?
Yeah, I mean, I think the boys will be boys narrative should be, you know, like, cracked down and eliminated as much as possible. But I think it's a legitimately tricky question of how teams and the NFL should best deal with it. And I think the answer is to deal with everything on a case-by-case basis and have there not be any loopholes in which the league or teams can exploit to interfere with investigations and helping the victims.
Yeah. The Raiders tried to, again, as we pointed out, the Raiders tried to play down the contract and say it's a one-year prove-it deal. Your colleagues over at The Root point out that Colin Kaepernick also deserves a prove-it deal, but in the NFL, there's always room for racist white men. Since the majority of the league is compromised of minorities, when do you think this changes for the NFL? Could this cause a chasm within the MNFLPA as they try to negotiate a new NFL collective bargaining agreement with the owners?
Yeah, I think the NFLPA actually is in a pretty strong position. The NFL really wants to get this new contract negotiated and finished so they can go ahead and start the bidding for the next television rights contract. So I think the NFLPA does have a chance to really leverage that. The question is, will they? There's been a lot of kind of division within the NFLPA that my colleague Dom Constantino has reported on very well. So I'm not exactly sure how it's going to end up, but there's certainly an opportunity.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's really pressing them and the NFLPA should really use this as leverage is I've been talking, I have a friend that joined me on my previous iteration of the show, Neil DeMoss, who we've always talked about the sports rights bubble and when it's going to burst. So I think the NFL is trying to get it that taken care of before the sports rights bubble does burst. And so the NFL, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, Neil is great. He's I love reading his work.
Yeah, he's really awesome. For show prep, let's see. I think I messed that up or rewrote that question. Moving on to the Boston Bruins, who are currently in the NHL Finals. They are tied with the St. Louis Blues at one game apiece. On Twitter, the Bruins promoted their new marketing partnership with Barstool Sports. The activation for the partnership currently sits at the Boston Bruins and Barstool Sports having logo towels to wave at the championship home games. Give the listeners a background on Barstool Sports and its founder, Dave Pornoy, is that his name?
Portnoy.
Portnoy, okay. Yeah, that's a hard one. Okay.
So Barstool Sports is a media company that was founded as a free newspaper in Boston in the early 2000s. And is now a website and podcast and radio network that bills itself as comedy as much as sports, but that comedy that they say is part of their brand is often wildly sexist and racist. And, you know, it's kind of exhausting to reel off the list of the site, but I can give you a couple for your listeners. But sure. So, Dave Portnoy, the founder, has said that Ferguson protesters should be shot for blocking traffic. He asked if Serena Williams could rape a man. He says that women who wear size 6 jeans deserve to be raped. Most recently, he explained why former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski mocking immigrant children who were locked in cages at the border was actually funny. He said he wanted to suffocate ESPN Sam Ponder in an online war. He's appeared on Tucker Carlson's yell about Colin Kaepernick kneeling to protest police brutality and PC culture in general. And that's not even getting into the rest of Barstool, which has, you know, had to delete tens of thousands of posts because they stole it from other people without credit. They just shut down the comment section because its commenters were too racist. They recently had to apologize for doing blackface. So I think you kind of get the idea here. That also doesn't even mention that he has personally sexually harassed me for a year. So,
well, yeah, he was suspended for Twitter for like 12 hours for like harassing you. And was that the end of it on Twitter, or did he actually get more?
No, recently, as yesterday, he was back at it, and Twitter doesn't care at this point.
I always liked your former colleague's Ashley Feinberg piece where she had the Twitter founder. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. And basically, he admitted that he has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah, that was great.
Barstool fans are notoriously vile white men who claim they are in it for the yucks. This rhetorical device is also what the alt-right uses as well. Where do you see the media landscape going if, like, the Bruins find this a worthy partner for a media partnership?
Yeah. Well, I think that the Bruins aren't the only legitimate organization to align themselves with Barstool, who, as you point out, uses the exact same strategies as the alt-right. I mean, Barstool even, you know, promotes the MAGA hats on their site, for example. So it's not, the line between them is pretty thin at this point. But I think that, you know, the Bruins are going to have to answer to this one way or another, whether that's fans who you know, stop buying tickets or stop buying merchandise or stop supporting the team because they don't want to co-sign Barstool, or, you know, NHL is going to get involved and say, hey, what's going on with this? I can't imagine the league is happy that the Bruins decided to partner with Barstool when they have an ongoing campaign called for Everyone or Hockey for All, which aims to bring in more diversity of fans and be more inclusive, and Barstool is the antithesis of that.
Well, it's funny that they have Hockey for All, because I was going to bring up, as a Kings fan, Los Angeles Kings, I always have to deal with the fact that it's not Live Nation, I just blanked on the name, but they also put on Coachella, and the founder of the owner of that group is notoriously anti-LGBT, and it's almost like the hockey version of Chick-fil-A.
Who is that?
It's AEG. Tim Lecky was an underling, and he's gone. He moved to a different company, but I always forget. He owns a Galaxy, the Kings and part of the Lakers. I think he has first rights to the Lakers when the Buses decide to sell.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Which, as you document on the site, it's kind of a crap show over there, and that could be any time. As most things happen these days, the partnership was announced via a tweet. You reached out to the team because you had a lot of valid questions about it, and the Bruins VP of Communications, Matt Chmura, wrote back, "We will not be communicating on this activation." Is this unique in your experience as a sports reporter?
Such a blessed phrase. We will not be commenting on this activation. They actually sent that exact same statement to every reporter who asked about it, and I was heartened to see that many reporters were pressing the Bruins on this promotion. So, and it is definitely surprising. You know, usually sports teams are begging reporters to cover their promotions, whether it's some like special hot dog that they made or some partnership with a celebrity or any sponsorship. It behooves them to try to get it as much as possible. So the fact that they were walking this back, didn't want to talk about it, maybe were ashamed or embarrassed or, you know, shamed into silence about it, I think definitely speaks volumes about how ill-advised the whole idea was.
One of the features of Deadspin that I love a lot is called Dead Letters. It's where you post, you and your colleagues post unedited hate mails that the writers received. Often the women of Deadspin get the more violent, angry mail than the men on average. Has it gotten any better in your tenure at Deadspin, or has misogyny online escalated in scale?
It hasn't gotten any better, but I can't say it's gotten any worse. It is just always sometimes shocking to me how much worse it is for the women. And I know it shouldn't really be surprising. I mean, a whole point of this is, fragile masculinity lashing out, and I get that. But, you know, my colleagues, Tamara Khalaf and Tom Lay especially, have written a ton of really good reports on Barstool. And my colleague, Drew McGarry, wrote a really good post about how people should stop enabling Barstool. And they also face horrible backlash, but it's, I mean, just like the level of violent and sexualized hate that I get, either on Twitter or on email, or people will try to find me on Instagram. You know, I mean, it's just a whole nother level that doesn't happen when I write about any other sports media company or any other topic in general.
Have there ever been connections between the alt-right? Since their targeted harassment is a lot like Gamergate and some of the other things the alt-right is known for, has there ever been any Discord chat logs, for example, or anything that ties Barstool to the wider right-wing groups?
I think that would be definitely something worthwhile to look at. I suspect that there is a hefty overlap there. I mean, just looking at the replies that I get, so they're almost always peppered with language, like, or I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on the show, but it's
you can't swear on the show.
Okay, I won't. It's a lot of talking about liberals and you know, how wow, it's really hard to do without cursing, but yeah, it's definitely politically motivated.
Yeah, and do we still have you?
Yeah, I'm
cool.
Here.
Okay, so do you have anything else you want to leave listeners off with, or does that pretty much cover it?
I think we pretty much covered it. I just hope that everyone else, who every other famous person out there who is considering cozying up to Barstool, fights at it.
Yeah, definitely. My guest has been Laura Wagner. She writes at Deadspin. You can find all of her really awesome articles there. Thanks for joining me on my show this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. This is the Heather McCoy Show. I've been kind of going back and forth on doing open lines for the next segment. Part of it is I can tell you a story. So it's a little bit on the energy level side for me, but I feel like I have dominated the conversation here at KBOO since I've come on the air, and I've never had you, our guests, as the callers. So our number is 503-231-8187, and that's going to be the number to dial to get on the air. If you want to just chat about some of the shows that I've done, or about some of the guests that I've done, or if you have anything else that you would like to chat about, literally the lines are going to be open. We're going to be right back. This is flying by the seat of my pants, and this is kind of scary, but we're going to do it. I'm going to transition to this segment by playing Tin in the Swear Jar in a song called Halsbot. This is, of course, the Heather McCoy Show.
I did something bad. I got in a fight about drugs. Kicked him in the neck. I'm high.
I say to Joe, do your pants ever just fall off? A menage, it was fine.
Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome back to the Heather McCoy Show. So you might have heard on KBOO earlier last night, actually, that I was going to have Jamie Stewart from Tin in the Swear Jar. That's what I just played. That was his old band, Juju. And so there's a weird story about that. So it was kind of this thing where they played Portland last week. It was a great show. I was there. But I wasn't able to do an interview with them before the show because I had other obligations I had to meet. And so then the label rep at Polyvinyl, we were trying to set up another time, and then we set it up for yesterday where they were traveling between San Francisco and Los Angeles. And they were in the city of Gilroy, and we were about 3 minutes into the program, and Jamie's phone completely died. We were able to get some texts going, but not a whole lot, and it just was gone. So I'm trying desperately to get Juju back on the air. They have a new album out called I think it's Girl with a Painted Flower. I'm botching it. I already know that. So that was kind of a weird mishap. And of all my years in radio, I have never had anything quite like yesterday happen. So it was just being on standby for 12 hours. And so I do apologize if you're tuning in hoping to hear a live interview with Jamie Stewart from Juju. And that's kind of what happened there. So the number is 503-231-87. I'm inviting your calls. It could be literally about any topic. It's open phones. You can ask me what I think about Frank Zappa, or you could just like comment on the show. We've had a lot of shows at this point. So I've had Chris Stroop on from, he's one of the leaders in the ex-evangelical movement. I've had Johann Hurry on with his book about overcoming depression and how it's a social cause. There's literally a lot of topics that you could be calling about. It's again, the number is 503-231-8187. A very rare chance thus far to communicate with the host directly. It's open lines. One of the stories I was reading before I got here was just released actually on the New York Times. There's a deceased GOP strategist, and so for the 2020 census, they are going to have a citizenship question, or that's what the Trump administration is trying to do. There's a Washington person, a Republican operative named Thomas B. Hoffler, who is somebody even though that the lead paragraph starts off with saying he's achieved near mythic status within the Republican Party, it's one of those names you haven't heard before. He's not one of the Karl Rove types or one of the other weirdos that associate on that group. Who's the Regency guy that started Cambridge Analytica? I always forget their names too. Like, they're not that level of Koch brothers. There's a number of well-known people who try to stay in the background. The owner of the Cubs, the other family. I can't think of their name off the top of my head. But so this person is truly kind of like an underground sensation within the Republican Party. And he passed away, and there's an archive of his hard drive, and his estranged daughter actually put it out there, found the hard drive, and apparently Mr. Hoffler played a critical role in the Trump's administration to add the citizenship question to the 2020 census. And so he did it way back in 2015 before Trump was even president, and he concluded that adding a citizenship question to the census would allow Republicans to draft even more extreme gerrymandered maps to stymie the Democrats. And so I don't think a lot of people realize, and this is the planner geek in me, that how much the census depends on where you get funding for your community, how much funding you get. It determines your voting districts. There's so much that's predicated on the census. And it's not just a decennial census that comes out every 10 years. It's also the American Community Survey, or ACS, which took the place of the long form starting back in 2000. And so there's so much census data out there, and it's so context rich. There's actually something called tiger data. And this is the type of data that these people use. The tiger data is actually spatial location data of income, whether or not you drive to work or not. All these questions you can find out spatially through a program. And then you don't know, many of you may have not heard of this program before, but it's called ArcGIS. And so ArcGIS can do a lot of good. You can actually identify different lots in a city that are approximately 1/4 mile to public transit and that are empty. So you can take a lot inventory within seconds and say, oh, this is what infill that we have in our city. This is how we can maximize it. Do we need parking requirements 1/4 away from the city? 1/4 mile city? Probably not. So we can ditch the parking requirements, build more housing more cheaply because parking is usually expensive because you have to do an underground garage. It goes so on and so on. So ArcGIS isn't this like evil, creepy company that Peter Thiel has started or anything like that Lord of the Rings thing that he has that's helping ICE. It's something that can be used for good and used for bad. And this guy definitely used it for bad. That's how politicians, if you see those maps that look like crooked, like orifices of the human body, and you wonder why, like, how did they get drawn up in those ways? ArcGIS. I mean, that's how they're doing it. And they're doing it through tiger data sets from the census. And they're targeting what people within the demographics are going to vote for them. And so this guy actually tried to add the citizenship question because the Republicans at this point know their ideas are so extreme. As Noam Chomsky often notes, their ideas are so off the chart to the right that it's just unbelievable. As we've seen with voter ID laws and a ton of other things that Republicans have done in the last, last 15, 20 years, they're not interested in democracy. They just play lip service to it. They're looking for minority rule. And this minority rule is not going to be good. It's going to be corporate driven, and it's going to be, they're going to not stop until they have total power. And they're not bargaining in good faith. And just the fact that Mitch McConnell yesterday goes, oh, well, you know, if there's a Supreme Court justice that opens up in 2020, we'll be more than happy to take the appointment and actually vote on it. And so it's basically it's basically our country's death of democracy by a little thousands of administrative things that people really don't take the time to notice. And I'm guessing this story is going to go away within, you know, 5-6 days. And then Democrats aren't going to keep bringing it up and saying these people are opposed to the idea of democracy. Because if you're trying to do undercounts of people based on their immigration status, what do you think you're doing with that? You're underfunding urban areas, which tend to vote blue. You're punishing them. You're trying to reduce their voting power because you're scared that you're going to have a neighbor of color next door to your house at any day of any time. A lot of it is predicated on white racism and like absolute fear of other. And it's quite frankly disgusting and disheartening that we can't seem to keep our focus on that very long. Remember whatever happened to defund or abolish ICE? That was a thing. Like, where were you on, like, every candidate had the answer, like, where are you on abolishing ICE? That just went down the memory hole, didn't it? So a lot of things in our society, it come down to attention span, and it's something that unfortunately we're not very good at, and then the people that are kind of thought of as weird cranks. So anyways, the number 503-231-8187. This is the Heather McCoy Show. This is what I forget what it's called now. It's what President Trump calls administrative time or executive time, where it's completely unplanned and you have an ability to shape it. So the number again is 503-231-8187. We're taking your calls literally on anything. And I mean literally anything. Like, it really, really, really doesn't matter. I like those kind of open shows like that where anything goes. And so, yeah, going back to that, there's this discussion that I got into last night. And basically, I'm a part of a Facebook group that is small developer. It's basically a Facebook group for small developers around the United States. And because I got introduced into that group because I was trying to do analysis, precedent or case study analysis on a development that I was doing for an urban design studio class in city and regional planning back at Cal Poly. And it was our sophomore regional design class or our urban planning class. And a lot of the case studies I was coming across were like big cities, like Pittsburgh, you know, New York, all these really large cities. And I found this Facebook group because, like, our project was never going to fit that, like, scale, because our project was the old Morro Bay power station plant. And so I've been a part of this group for probably now 3 years. And yesterday somebody asked about, like, what can you do zoning-wise to limit how McMansions as in your city, so like you're not building the lot line and you're not like three stories or four stories and all the other stuff that goes out of the character of the neighborhood. And so that's a legitimate question to ask. McMansions are a problem. I don't see them nearly as much as in Portland as I do in other parts of the country, noticeably near beach communities where you get those like pillars of death that come up near beach communities. That are usually three stories and very, like, they're almost shotgun houses from New Orleans. And so in that discussion, like, I brought up suburbia and how suburbia was founded, and it's founded on white supremacy. You had government-backed loans that could not be doled out to people or they couldn't be underwritten by given out to people that, of color. And it enabled white flight. And so, when people that defend the status quo, they go, oh, but the market says, the market is just their way of defending the status quo because they don't want to think anything beyond that. I do have a caller on the line. We have Jersey is on hold. Thanks for calling the Heather McCoy Show. First open lines that I've ever done, and I think it's going well. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Heather.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think you hit on something in terms of that whole memory lapse about it and the concept of the democracy. The Republicans are really good at just repeating a couple of key sound bites over and over again that sink in. And I don't understand why the Democrats haven't absorbed to just keep repeating the loss of democracy as part of this. Just the loss of democracy. Just whatever they say is an issue, finish it with the loss of democracy. And as a former campaigner, I can kind of basically say it could actually work. And on top of everything else, the fear, of course, I have to look at is they're afraid to bring it up because the irony would be too much of what the Democratic leadership did to Bernie and as they're doing now to Tulsi Gabbard. And so I think it really comes around, and the progressives in the Democratic Party, who are not the ones who have to declare themselves progressives, they're the ones, yeah, who actually have votes. The ones who actually have votes in progressives. Basically, they have a big thing to fill while they're basically being put, you know, a greased floor to get there. They could force a couple of key Democrats that are just on the line to come around and just get this message out and not be afraid of the consequences, which you can't be. You really, because this is about saving us, you know?
Yeah, well, I don't think the DCCC leadership is particularly interested in that. Like, they were the ones that came up with those rules that said that if you're doing an insurgent campaign, you're dead to us and you're dead professionally, right, to us. They're like an anti-democratic organization of themselves.
Right, and that's why everyone else has to just repeat the line over and over again about democracy being a requirement. It is pretty much, I'm pretty sure that the leadership is most afraid of hearing, because it comes down to it, you know, and Bernie wasn't the first one they've done this to.
No, they haven't. Like, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but there is a mayoral candidate in San Francisco in the year 2000, and he was running against Gavin Newsom. The mayoral candidate was a Green Party member, and he actually had some really good positions. And I think it was just a DNC at that point. They shipped in, like, the big heavies at the time, like Bill Clinton and Joe Lieberman, because Joe Lieberman carried weight back in the day, which is so hard to believe. He was just such a little creep. They basically, I think it was Gonzalez, but I can't think of his first name. They don't seem to be very interested in that at all. So then the question becomes is, how do you work within and without within the party and aside from the party to push him in the right direction? Because, like, that's one of the big complaints with the DCCC about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is she didn't, quote, wait her turn. And then that gives the credence and that gives the reasoning and why all of the Hillary supporters would go, it's her turn, because they believe democracy goes in turns and not by, like, actually winning elections.
Right. Good. Very good call on that. And I just want to add something funny to the end of this that I thought
absolutely
was really poignant. So we were only in 15 Democratic candidates, a month or two ago, when my wife brought up the point is that I'd been mentioning how many sort of individual select candidates seemed to fit the category of what they were looking for in terms of voters to please, to basically say, not Bernie, you have all these others. And including, of course, Lieberman coming out, you know, and hinting that he was going to run, saying, okay, you got to get the old guy. You got to get people who look different. You got to get everyone had their own category. And then she said something pretty funny. She says, yeah, can you tell? It's like it takes 15 of those to equal one Bernie.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing that's working up against Bernie is there's no element of surprise. Like, it was generally surprising. Someone that calls themselves a socialist was actually, you know, almost able to beat Hillary Clinton. And so I think that element of surprise is taken away, as you rightfully kind of suggest within your comment. And it's going to be a very hard road to climb because of that. They're prepared this time.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for your call. Ira is up next. Ira, you're on the Heather McCoy Show.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm surprisingly awake. I've been up since 5 in the morning, and I've been on standby for almost 48 hours. But how are you doing?
I don't know if we can have a conversation if you're asleep, though.
No, I'm pretty awake. Like, it's kind of weird where there's a switch in my head that turns on when I'm behind the microphone of any radio station, and I'm instantly alert. So what's your call?
There's something seriously. I hope you don't regret opening your line, but I have been away up at Seattle at the Folklife Festival.
Uh-huh.
I just got back. And I got back a couple of days ago when Paul Rowland had his radio show, his talk show.
Yeah.
He's someone I followed for a long time. He's done a lot of useful work for KBOO, and, you know,
I was engineering him for at one point, and then the early mornings are getting too much for me. But what about Paul Rowland?
Well, anyway, he alarmed me by saying that there were things happening that he couldn't talk about. And I looked at my email. I still haven't read my email. I've been away. I got a letter about KBOO. And it looks like KBOO might be in the middle of a takeover, but he couldn't talk about it. I wasn't fully listening to
it. I think that's overstating it by a long shot.
What do you know about it? That's really what I'm calling for. What can you say about it?
I really can't say much, but the thing I can say is that KBOO is an inclusive community, and we're trying to resolve our differences of opinion. I certainly have my difference of opinion. And I think we'll leave it at that. I mean, every organization goes through this kind of thing.
A couple of minutes ago, you were talking about democracy.
Yeah.
And the thing about KBOO that's been since the beginning was, you know, it's supposed to be based on democratic principles. So nobody should be prevented from talking about it. And I remember in the 1980s, KPFA, which produces Democracy uh-huh. Now! And Flashpoints and all that, it had some problems, and they couldn't talk about it. Why should KBOO? You just told me exactly what I heard Paul Rowland say. Why not just air everything? Why should we be afraid to talk about what everyone's thinking about? And I don't. To tell you the truth, I'm coming out of nowhere. I didn't hear anything about this, and all the only thing I have is this email I haven't quite read yet, which is very long. Why is it that you and Paul can't say anything about it?
Well, it's not like there's no one forcing us to say, like, let me put it this way. There's no mandate on Paul and I saying that we can't say anything. It's like you follow KPFA. KPFK had something in Los Angeles, had something similar.
Yeah, I don't follow it now, but this was a long time ago.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying is you follow community radio. I mean, this is part and parcel to part of how community radio stations run from time to time. I was a part of it at KUCI down in Irvine. We had one of these things happen. Eventually, things get sorted out, feelings get mended, and we all move together forward. And it's just one of those things where it's just not productive. In a world that's collapsing, and for you know, Comcast, the world's collapsing. Comcast doesn't want to talk about it. You know, all the cable stations that they provide, it's just gibberish. And so, whatever is happening at KBOO is not even in comparison to whatever is happening out in.
Now, I'm not saying that it's very. It's the comparable to Julian Assange or anything like that.
No,
I'm saying that we shouldn't be afraid to talk. And I know what. I just know that one of the bedrocks, if you look at the written statements behind KBOO, it's all democracy. The people should be told.
Yeah, and absolutely. And so if you want to be told, KBOO has open board meetings.
I know. It's hard for me to do that. There's one on Monday. I may force myself to go.
I think you should go. Because you sound like you're concerned, and you have every right to be concerned, and you should go. I would urge anybody.
Is that all the feel that you can say about it? Is that correct?
That's all I really want to say about it. And that's it's not okay. So like again, like I would urge anyone that has seen the email. I think I've seen it, but I'm not sure if it's the exact email in question. But
Linda Osterlund there.
Yes, then I have seen it. I have seen that email. I haven't I've read a lot to prep for the show, so it's I'm not having recall on it instantly right now.
And I haven't even read my email yet. I just got back a couple days.
Yeah, I would read the whole thing and come to our board meeting and ask questions, because I think Linda lays it out pretty thoroughly in that email.
Okay, well, I'll read it, and I do think, though, it's a good idea not to be afraid to talk about this.
Believe me, I am not afraid to say literally anything.
Okay, well, that's good.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm more concerned with other issues. I think the Julian Assange thing, I didn't even hear what was said this morning, but I heard a little bit of it. It sounds pretty bad.
Well, the thing that concerns me about Julian Assange the most, and since you brought it up, is the fact that, you know, you have quote-unquote, and I think Jeremy Scahill brought this up on his Twitter feed, is that you have quote-unquote liberals going calling for his head. He's the press. Sometimes you're not going to like what the press reports. And you know, in liberals' cases, they enjoyed the Chelsea Manning leaks, and they didn't enjoy the Hillary Clinton leaks. And, sorry. That's the ball, way the ball goes, you know. It's weird that everyone thinks that you're picking teams. Journalism is not a team sport, you know.
I think it's better to put everything out and not say, I'm not criticizing you, I'm not criticizing KBOO. I'm just saying it's better to put everything out rather than to say we can talk about this, but we can't talk about that. You said you're free to talk about whatever you want, but you don't want to talk about it. I respect that, but it just seems to me it's better if everybody knows. I'm at a loss because I don't know anything right now.
I would urge you to read the email.
And then
the other thing, too, is like... Let's just say, for example, C-SPAN interrupted programming and then took you to an HR meeting at some corporation, and you have no context of what's going on, and you just walk into that meeting.
It's like
the Big Lebowski, you know. It's just like, Donnie, you're out of your element, you know. It's just like, if I can start saying stuff, and it's worth only the point of view that I have, and there's thousands of volunteers that are going to be having a different point of view, and so it's really pointless for me to just to talk about this for an hour where.
Okay.
You know, we have somebody... Yeah.
I'll just plead ignorance and hope to learn more.
Absolutely. And go to the board meetings. Everyone that is interested in this issue that he brings up, go to the meeting.
I've been to many board meetings. It's hard to do it for me, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Okay, so the next step is Mitch. We have very little time.
I know, and I can't get into what I wanted to talk about, which was the previous call, which was the guy before the previous caller. But the previous caller makes some points about this crisis at KBOO that can't be talked about, and you did a very nice job there, Ms. McCoy, in trying to frame why it would eat up all the time. And I would love to come to the board meeting. The problem is that a lot of the people that work at KBOO are independently wealthy, and I'm a wage slave, and a lot of times I can't make it to a 6 p.m. starting meeting. And I think that these meetings used to start at 7 or 8 that were open to the public, and if people are working, getting to a 6 p.m. meeting on a work night, a weeknight, is almost impossible. And I'm very sorry that that is the case. If there's still a second to talk about what you were talking about before in the Democratic Party...
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
I literally have maybe $200 to my name. I am not wealthy. I am very much a wage slave. So we're not...
But you know that structurally, volunteer labor runs on trustafarians, okay?
Okay.
The people that work for a living don't have the freedom like Ms. Bernstein to just come on and play like she's a champion of labor when in fact she's never had to punch a clock in her life. So, you know.
Okay. So backing
this
up,
this is a problem I've had with progressive media. It runs by privilege.
Stop. Okay. So I clock in and I clock out every day. If I'm 9 minutes late, I'm written up. If I ask to go home early because I'm out of PTO, I get written up. The fact that volunteer labor is only for the wealthy and the hoity-toity is bullcrap. It's absolute bullcrap. That is the Heather McCoy Show. That was awesome. Let's do that again sometime. Hopefully Juju is up next week. We'll see. We'll see if Jamie Stewart gets his cell phone working. Until then, this is the Heather McCoy Show.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vocal Improv Jam, taking place monthly on the first Sunday at 4:30 p.m. at Riverfront Commemorative Park in Corvallis. The Vocal Improv Jam is open to all, with no experience or music background needed. The jam is based on Bobby McFerrin's Circle Singing. The event explores and develops musicality in a safe, supportive, and fun setting. Again, that's the Vocal Improv Jam this month on Sunday, June 2nd from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at Riverfront Commemorative Park, 2nd Northwest 1st Street in Corvallis. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to Morgan Parker about her new book, Magical Negro. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Join us on Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. for KBOO's 51st birthday party and birthday cake potluck. Bring a birthday cake if you can and celebrate the existence of 51